Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Alright, lads and lasses, welcome to the Geordie special edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. I'm Aidan Williams, and we're venturing up to the true north of England through the fog on the Tyne, listening to Lindisfarne and Gaza, and putting on our classic 90s black and white shirts, winding our way up to the cathedral on the hill that is St. James's Park, taking our seats high up in level 7, no doubt. Anyone who's made that trip knows exactly what I'm talking about there.
I've done that a few times.
It's where the family enclosure is too, Stephen, so have I. It's magazine time here at These Football Times, a special one for me. If the clues so far haven't given away, we're talking my very own Newcastle United. They're the focus of our magazine attentions this time around. Now, while I appreciate none of my fellow podders share my heritage and footballing affiliation, this is not, I promise, just going to be an Aidan Williams monologue in rough Geordie vernacular. I have a couple of colleagues to try and rein me in a little. You've already heard from one of them. He's our very own curly-haired star stuck in the 1980s, so I guess he's the Kevin Keegan of the episode for us. Stephen, evening.
Good evening, good evening. My curls are purely natural. They are not permed. Someone said that I was, what did they compare me to at the weekend before the Liverpool-Fulham game? Like John Power's younger brother. I think I got the, on Saturday. So yeah, I can be the Keegan of the show. I'm happy with that.
Yeah, well, you have a foot in both Keegan camps in this country anyway, don't you? So that sounds about right. And also we have an FA Cup obsessive who thinks the competition was far better in the past. What could be more Newcastle United than that? He is very much under instruction to only discuss 1950s cup exploits. Nothing bad that happened in the 70s, Dave. We'll see how that goes. Good evening.
Yes, that's not going to last for very long, is it? It's... As somebody whose clue is never, ever going to get a TFT magazine, it's nice to be talking about at least a team in stripes.
This is the closest we're going to get. Okay, then. So the magazine itself will be out on the 2nd of January, featuring the usual mix of fabulous artwork and features, all with a magnificent black and white hue. Just to run through what is in the magazine, we have... Early 20th century glory, we have to go back that far, sadly, yes. Early 20th century glory and the great Huey Gallagher, the first iconic Newcastle number 9. Then we move on to Jackie Milburn and the 1950s FA Cup successes and the Fairs Cup of 1968-69. And then all that success suddenly disappears, so we have to discuss other things from that point on. There's an Alan Kennedy interview talking of cup runs as well from the 1970s. There's a piece on the 80s Mavericks of Waddle Beardsley and Gascoigne, who all obviously disappeared off elsewhere for their real peaks, sadly. There's two penned by yours truly here on the Tyne and Wear Derby. Very parochial, a very one-sided piece, I'm sure you will not be surprised to hear. And also I delve into Keegan's entertainers. There's separate pieces on cult hero of Tino Asprilla. There's Alan Shearer, there's a Sir Bobby Robson era. Lauren Robert even gets a piece in here, a bit of a cult status and a crazy fun piece, it says here in my notes. So there we go. We'll see how that one comes over. There's more modern stuff about the PIF takeover and Eddie Howe and the current era, as well as odes to St. James's Park and the greatest Newcastle kits. Now, obviously, I am purely biased, but the greatest modern kit of the Premier League era is very much a Newcastle United one. Anyway, plenty to get stuck into there. Now, we are a club that's had to live in the past quite a lot, as that list goes on about, certainly if we want to talk of anything approaching actual glory. League champions a few times, believe it or not, in the early 20th century. FA Cup heroes repeatedly in the 1950s, and then that European glory in the late 60s, and then, well, not a lot since then. Now, Stephen, you have written about the 1950s FA Cup successes, I believe, and Newcastle won the Cup 3 times in 5 years. At that stage, I think that was a run that was only by some of the real pioneering days of the tournament where not very many teams took part. I guess recent seasons have seen some of the usual suspects winning with similar regularity, but back then that was quite the big achievement, I think, in that era, wasn't it?
It was indeed. You know, fascinated. Always, there's always been something that catches the eye. You know, when you run your finger down the winners of the FA Cup in the day, certainly days before the Premier League kicked in, when it was truly kind of anyone's game. And, Bolton in the 1920s, stand out because there they are with three wins in the 20s, and then Newcastle go and do it in the 50s. Tottenham in the 60s, back-to-back 61-62, but again in 67. You know, so there's something quite, that draws you towards, what was it about that team that made them so successful in, a very difficult competition to win? It's not a tournament, it's a competition. Cups are competitions, they're not tournaments. So yeah, we'll get that straight as well in my article, which does run to about 6,000 words. You'll be glad to know. So within that, this team, the name Jackie Milburn, has been one I've known for years, but to be able to kind of like get into that, that kind of peel off the layers basically to find out who he was and just how good he was and what type of player he was and how that team played. It's the Robledo brothers. It's all of these things. It's Bobby Mitchell on the wing, learning about these players. So it's one of these articles where I've been able to learn as I go at the same time. There's things that I knew. There's things that I didn't know. And it's fascinating how it progresses. And the fact that Newcastle come out of the Second World War as a second division club, reach the semi-finals before winning promotion. So they've had this kind of like run at it, a bit like landing on the moon, going around the moon, not landing, and then coming back. That's 1948-49. It was all 47-48, and then to go on and beat Matthews Blackpool in 1951. It is a stunning achievement for a team that's recently out of the second division. Against a team that's got the icon of Matthews and Mortensen and Perry and all of those great names of that Blackpool era involved with them, that who've recently played an FA Cup final, themselves against Manchester United, I think 48. So that they had all of the pedigree and Newcastle. When they reached the final in 51, it's the first time in 19 years that they've done so. They're a rising force again. They've known great days, but at that point in time, it's Blackpool and the real deal rather than Newcastle going into that final. And it's fascinating to plot the path to the final, which, I know how to do that. It's, Ernie Taylor being part of that side for Newcastle as well. And, who goes on to move to Blackpool and win the cup again in 53 in that Matthews final, and even to go on and play for Manchester United post Munich in the 1958 final. It was special dispensation, I think, given to him to go and play for Manchester United and that and be part of that team that reaches the 58 cup final and loses to Bolton. But yeah, that Newcastle side to go and retain the cup in 52 as well. June and those kind of June seasons of consistency in the league as well. So, the fact that here's a Newcastle that are, very much on an even keel, more than just on an even keel, that they're proving themselves in the very early 1950s as being, suddenly the not new money as such, but the it's a new rise of a familiar entity basically. But they put themselves into the mix of things very, very impressively. And when they retain the cup in 52, they're the first team to do so since Blackburn Rovers in the the 1890s. 60 years have passed. No team has retained the FA Cup in 60 years at this point in time when Newcastle go and do it. And they beat Arsenal in the 52 final. Prior to Newcastle winning in 51, Arsenal the last team to win the FA Cup. They'd beaten some team from Merseyside in the 1950 final, which may or may not play in red, although didn't play in red at Wembley that day. So yeah, this achievement in winning the cup in 52 is pretty phenomenal as well. Although, be it against a 10-man Arsenal in the end because they lose Wally Barnes, so no substitutes and all of that type of stuff. But this is still the fascination of that final, is that despite Arsenal going down to 10 men for much of the game, it's Arsenal that go on the front foot because they've got nothing else they can do. They've just got to go for it. and Newcastle have to, you know, play this, it's kind of like absorb the pressure and hit on the break. And it makes it for a fascinating rather than the classic final people were going to, you know, were billing it as potentially to be. But what's amazing about that, and I'll not go too much into it, you know, because you want people to read the article, but it's Newcastle's run to that final as well is a treacherous one. There's, you know, Arsenal included, they play four first division teams that finish above them that season in the league. You know, a season in which they finish eighth, you know, a creditable eighth in a really competitive first division. You know, four of the teams that they have to face down on that run finish above them. You know, four of the seven teams finish above them in the league that year. And it's a phenomenal achievement to go and do that. And then it was fascinating as well, unpicking the 54-55 side, which is wildly different. You know, there's still some familiar faces in there, but just finding, and what was a surprise to me was finding out just how dysfunctional Newcastle have become at that point in time. You know, there's a, you know, a flirtation with relegation the previous couple of seasons, but there's a lot of churn at Newcastle at that point in time. So, you know, many of the players who'd been part of the 51 and 52 cup winning side have moved aside. And then you've got this fresh set of players almost with a few familiar faces in there. And the fact that, you know, the managerial turnover as well is that, you know, Stan Seymour, who's everything at Newcastle because he's been an FA Cup winning player, you know, back in the day. And then he's been coach, he's been manager, he's been director, selector, and then eventually chairman by the time the 55 cup final comes along. And, you know, his successor as manager, it's a fella called Dugald Livingstone. He's someone who's coached, you know, Belgium at the 1954 World Cup. He's coached Sparta Rotterdam. So he comes with his expansive continental ideas, which is fascinating to read through. When you come and, you know, you're reading through match reports from that season and the way that they are. And it's a season in which they are the highest scorers, the joint highest scorers in the first division, yet no one in the top half of that division concedes more than Newcastle. And there's only four teams in the bottom half that concede more than them, which again, it's kind of like a prototype of many of the Newcastles that will come later on, in that, you know, all and nothing at the same time kind of effect, yet they blunder their way through almost through that 1954-55 FA Cup, which just makes that such an alluring success, because they could have gone out on several occasions yet stumble their way through, playing a third division north side in the semi-final as well. You know, and it's just, it's a run that's got absolutely everything. And then in the end, they're up against Manchester City side that have the Reevey plan. You know, and all of that, you know, and it's, you know, what they do is quite phenomenal, to win those three FA Cups within such a short space of time. It is. I mean, even beyond that, you know, the fact that that plot line of where they go after that, you know, which I'm not going into with the article, because it'd end up being 12,000 words if I went and did that. But for me, you know, I've been fascinated plotting that route through the 50s and the complexities and the layers of it as well, which is why it ends up running to such a ludicrous, you know, word count, is that there's so much in it that you can't leave out. You have to put in, because it's massively relevant to the way that team changes, yet the success continues. And Milburn's part in that, from being, you know, this metronomic striker, you know, sometimes played on the wing, to being, you know, on the brink of being dropped for the 55 final if Livingstone had been allowed to have his way, you know, Seymour on the board vetoing them, basically, and to score 45 seconds into that 1955 final as way of riposte, basically. You know, it's an amazing era for Newcastle, yet it is massively layered. And it's one of those great stories that it's kind of, I don't know, I think there's a lot of parts of that many people who think they know the football, who I'd include myself in that, in writing research in this article, is just not knowing, you know, about it. And it's been a joy to write.
Oh, fantastic. And obviously Jackie Milburn, War Jackie, is, as he's known in these parties, he's one of the few people to have a statue outside St James's. And that obviously harks back to this era, the successes, the few successes that this club has had in, well, what should I say, post-Second World War era. Prior to that, it was a little more regular. But yeah, it's a fascinating time. And the photos of this time, these cup triumphs, are you see them pinned up in bars and pubs around the city still, because there's been so little to follow it, of course. But that does mean that the iconic names and players of that era are still quite fresh to mind without, as you say, knowing the full detail very well. I think a lot of people aren't familiar with how it all came about beyond knowing that Jackie Milburn scored a lot, scored early, and we were synonymous with FA Cup success at that period. And Dave, you know, I'm sure from your studies of FA Cups past, it's interesting to think that the club probably still is or feels sort of synonymous with the FA Cup, despite it all being so long ago. I think there's a fan base too. This has led to a general feeling that the Cup is really something important, despite a various ownership not seeing it that way at times, that it's a special thing.
You've stolen about the first half a dozen paragraphs of my article there. I think that is the case. As I grew up, born in 64, sort of growing up through the cup finals of the 70s, Newcastle were always one of those teams when the third round draw came out and they, you know, and here are the odds now. And Newcastle were always a team that were one of the favourites to win it because they'd, you know, they'd had that success in the 50s. And, you know, it was 20 years before. But I think once you establish that pedigree in the FA Cup, you know, and three cup wins in 5 years is out of the ordinary, less out of the ordinary these days, perhaps. But, you know, back when football was football, it was really out of the ordinary. And that's always meant that Newcastle is one of those teams that's sort of blessed by the FA Cup and will always be in the conversation about the FA Cup. You know, I mean, here we go again this season, Bromley, you know, in January in the third round, the start of another cup run all the way to Wembley, perhaps. I don't know. But you get that. When the third round draw comes, you get that feel. Newcastle are one of those teams that should be there, that should be in the conversation. And I do remember, I think I do remember anyway, in 74, sitting down for the cup final, and there was the grainy pictures, the Pathé News footage of those cup finals in the early 50s that were on the BBC warm up to the final. And I think Jackie Milburn, whether it was on the day or in the days leading up to the cup final, you know, he was there talking about it in various interviews and stuff. And that's what I've always thought of Newcastle as, even, you know, in the Keegan era when they were chasing the Premier League and stuff. Newcastle are a cup team. That's what they are. Now, the future may have something different, obviously, with the new ownership and stuff, if they're ever allowed to spend any money. But Newcastle will always be a cup team. Yeah, it's like what you were saying, I think, both you were saying on the 80s series, you know. I mean, you think of Chelsea as a second division football team, which... better days. But sorry, Gary.
We can dream.
But that, you know, that's kind of what you grow up with, isn't it? That's what you know, that stays with you forever. And for me, Newcastle are one of those teams that should be getting to the latter stages of the cups and being in cup finals and that, because it is that period that Stephen's writing about is what sort of made Newcastle a special team in that post-war era, and you'll never get away from it. And of course, John Lennon put one of those cup finals on the cover of Walls and Bridges. So, you know, that's another added point.
You're definitely right. I think from the fan base perspective, Newcastle fans are just desperate for a trophy. We don't care what. It's been so long, and like we were talking off air earlier, some of the clubs who have won things in the time since Newcastle United have. Many of them are vastly, vastly smaller outfits than Newcastle, and far less resource. Even in Newcastle's lean times, some of the clubs who've managed to achieve success that Newcastle haven't. And, you know, everyone's realistic enough to know that a cup is the most likely path to that kind of glory. The league title is some way beyond. Who knows, maybe in the future, or you know, we can all look at a year it maybe should have happened a quarter of a century or so ago. But the cups, either cup is the most likely path to some glory. And yeah, it just makes a pleasing change in modern times that actually they are trying to do that again and focusing on trying to be successful in the cups. But we shall see how that goes. I mean, you mentioned it briefly there, Dave. You wrote about the 74 cup run from Alan Kennedy's perspective. A theme for Alan Kennedy, I guess, is there's several in the decade that followed of local boys who played with their local club or one of the local clubs to them and then had to disappear off elsewhere for their real glory. But he had his moments with Newcastle. It was a hell of a campaign, that one.
Yeah, the 74 Cup run, I mean, although it didn't end the way that, well, that one of you would have wanted and the way that one of you would have wanted. I mean, it's one of those great epic stories. I mean, it starts with Hendon getting a draw at St James's Park. And now, you know, Hendon, a non-league club, decent non-league club at that time. I think they'd won the FA Vase or the trophy or whatever it was in the years leading up to it. And I'm not going to mention this again, Aidan, honestly. But, you know, just a couple of years on from that day.
You had to go there.
I did have to go there. Cause,
this,
you know,
there's a rule. There was an embargo on this.
No, hear me out. Alan Kennedy was going to go to the game at Airywood, and he went down the first one, which was postponed. He was halfway down to the second one when that got postponed, and the third one he was playing for Newcastle youth team on the so he couldn't go, and he was so pleased that he couldn't go. But he said, you know, when they got Hendon in the cup, there were still players from that team obviously still there, and he said, you know, there was this trepidation amongst the dressing room about, oh my God, it's not going to happen again, is it? And of course they got a draw at St James, and they played the replay at Watford at Vicarage Road, and Newcastle walked it and went through and Scunthorpe United. That had to go to a replay as well before they beat Scunthorpe. And then they played at the Albion in the fifth round, and I remember that game like it was yesterday. I mean, it's one of the games that made a huge impression on me for all sorts of reasons. But I mean, it was a proper 1970s FA Cup type pitch. I mean, it was like, you know, it was just mud everywhere. It was a ploughed field. It was horrendous. And I mean, people on the ground, staff I've spoken to at the Albion about that, and he said, you know, they've said 9 o'clock. The place was awash with Geordies at 9 o'clock in the morning before the game. You know, the ground was absolutely swamped by Newcastle supporters, which again, you know, says everything about that tradition of the FA Cup. You know, they'd come down to make sure that they got into the ground on the day, and Albion were in the second division at that time. And Alan Kennedy said to me that he missed that game, but the players had said to him, and a lot of people around the club, it was the best Newcastle had played in the cup for about 15, 20 years. And I mean, they wiped the floor with Albion. It was just a demolition. Stuart Barraclough, I remember, playing really, really well. John Tudor was a great player up front. Good foil for Malcolm McDonald. McDonald scored as well. And then you're into the sixth round. And when you're in the sixth round, and particularly if you're a club like Newcastle, that's when you start to get the smell of it. And you know, 20-odd years on, no FA Cup since then, but only 5 years since the Fairs Cup. So, you know, still a successful, and still knew what winning was. And they played Nottingham Forest in the second division at home. And the day didn't go well, really. I mean, that St James's was absolutely rammed to the rafters, and Alan Kennedy was on the bench, and Forrest played really well, and they were winning 3-1 after about an hour. Got a penalty, and Pat Howard had been sent off, scored the penalty 3-1, and Alan Kennedy was saying, you know, I was looking around, and they were banging on the top of the dugout, and they were, you know, there's going to be some trouble here. And he said, I looked to my left, and there was this big fella in a big jacket. And he shouted, come on, lads, we're going on. And everybody just followed this fella onto the pitch, and it was mayhem. I think it took 20 minutes to clear the pitch. Police dogs, the works. Yeah, it was a proper 1970s bonfire. Exactly what you want. All the things that people say, we don't want to see this kind of thing. Oh, yes, we do. That's exactly what we want to see. And they'd gone back to the dressing room, obviously, for 20 minutes. And I was sitting there all feeling miserable. And Alan Kennedy said, all of a sudden, John Tudor stood up and said, we can still win this. And everybody was laughing at him, basically. Don't be silly. We're rubbish here. We're getting murdered. We've got no chance. No, we can still win this. Kennedy came on as a sub when they came back out. And they turned it around. Bobby Moncur, they scored a second fairly quickly. And then Bobby Moncur scored late on as well, I think. It was about 2 yards offside, Alan Kennedy said. But there was no way that the referee was going to delay. And they'd won 4-3. There was still about 2 minutes to go. The referee, as soon as Bobby Moncur's goal went in, blew the final whistle, right, off we go. And that was it. And they'd won 4-3. They were through to the semi-final. Except then, of course, the inquest was you can't have a team, you know, you can't have a pitch invasion and when you're losing 3-1 and then the team go through. So there were all kinds of shenanigans because with the game having played to a finish, there was nothing the FA could do until Forest asked for the game to be annulled. So that game doesn't exist any longer in the record books. It was annulled. So they played it again. They played it at Goodison Park on neutral turf rather than at St James's, and it was a draw. And after that was a draw, they had the replay at Goodison Park as well. God knows what Forest would have had to have done to have had a game played at the City Ground. But anyway, and Newcastle finally came through and they're in the semi-finals and they played Burnley and they were in good nick by then, Newcastle. And he said, Alan Kenneth, they went away to Buxton and they went days in advance on a jolly, basically. I mean, they were drinking away and enjoying themselves for 2 or 3 days. He said it was the Midland Hotel in Buxton, which is on the hill as you come into the town in Buxton. And they went on the Friday night. Joe Harvey said, right, OK, we're going to be serious now because we're playing tomorrow, like in a cup semi-final. They all had dinner together and they were sitting there having dinner together. And he said there was this old lady at the piano playing Tiptoe Through the Tulips while Newcastle United's 20-year-olds, desperate for a pint, were all having their dinner, listening to this. They went out and they played and they beat Burnley, beat them comfortably. Cup final, Liverpool. They go down to London on the Monday. You can imagine, you know, 5 days away from home in a hotel, how well that went. But that was kind of an epiphany, really, for Kennedy, because, I mean, Newcastle were exactly how, I would say, probably 90 of the 92 clubs would have behaved that week, going to the cup final. Probably Liverpool and Leeds United were the only ones that wouldn't have behaved like this. But, you know, Newcastle, it was a bit of a jolly, and then there was the football writers' dinner on the Thursday. All of the Newcastle team went. Two of the Liverpool team went, and Ian Callan had won the bloody award. So Liverpool were all at the hotel getting prepared. And that was kind of the moment he thought, well, I want to do something with my career here, and they're doing it the right way. And that was, you know, 2 or 3 years later down the line, he moved on to Liverpool. But that's kind of a fault line, isn't it? You know, in professional football at that point, at 74, because everybody would have been like Newcastle. And they were all fascinated by the players' pool. And Malcolm McDonald had got a boutique and he'd sorted out black and white check suits for them all and God knows what else. Whereas Liverpool, everything was, you know, completely ordered. They discovered on the Thursday afternoon they hadn't got any tracksuits for Newcastle, so they ended up. I mean, you know, if you haven't seen it, go on YouTube for the footage because the purple things that they come out in are a sight to behold. I mean, they are unbelievable. apparently, they did have some tracksuits initially, and they were made of toweling material with flares. Which actually would have been even worse than the ones that they wore in the finish. But that was kind of how it was, you know. That was the Newcastle way, which would have been the way of, you know, the Albion. It would have been the way of Manchester City. It would have been the way of most clubs. And then Liverpool were there in the, you know, the proper stuff. And, you know, we all know what the cup final was like. After Malcolm McDonald had promised to turn Phil Thompson and Emily News inside out and score half a dozen goals and all of that. And poor old Alan, he was, I think, what was he, 18, 19, on the day of the cup final. They went to the, they always used to go to the hotel and they'd talk to the players before the game. And so they came to Alan. It was, I think he was one of the first to talk. And they said, so then, Alan, cup final day, what are you thinking about coming up against Tommy Smith? And he said, I just didn't expect the question. I didn't know what to say. I froze. So I said, who's Tommy Smith? Which I can't imagine went down particularly well in the Liverpool hotel. And, of course, in the finish, Tommy Smith embarrassed him in the last couple of minutes with playing the 1-2 round for the third goal. But it just is a microcosm of that whole 1970s. I mean, you know, me and you, Stephen, in the 70s series, we talked about the Mavericks. And the clubs were Mavericks as well, in a way. There was none of that professionalism that was to come later on and the attention to detail. It was all very much off the cuff. It's, yeah, I mean, Alan Kennedy is a fantastic talker. He's a great interviewee, you know. And it was an absolute pleasure talking to him. But it's just a time capsule. That whole thing is a time capsule, and there's lots of good stuff in it for Newcastle fans. Don't worry, Aidan. It's quite a, you know, there's a lot to enjoy in there, but it is kind of a cautionary tale as well, I suppose.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the beauty of first-hand accounts like that, isn't it? Of pulling back the curtain somewhat to knowing exactly what it was like compared to the bits that we see on our TV screens, and just how it was. It's fascinating. So that'll be a brilliant one to look at. Now, Steve and Dave alluded to it there, that Newcastle had won something only a few years before that as well. It's a fact probably easy forgotten to history for those outside of the city in many ways. Newcastle were one of the earlier English successes in European competition, which is something we cling to massively because it's the last success, a trophy lifted by Bobby Moncur, defensive captain and goal scorer on that occasion as well, in a rare situation. He's also famously better known in my family as the next door neighbour to my brother-in-law across in Gateshead, but that's another story. But yeah, Newcastle in Europe, Steve, and it was you know, your area of expertise, I'm sure, but you know, quite a ride that one was.
Yeah, you know, rightly proud of that, I think. You know, it was a wondrous era for English clubs in that particular competition. I mean, you throw in Man United winning the European Cup in 68, a year after Celtic had become the first British side to win, you know, well, big ears. But yeah, the first cup, very much at that point in time as well, teams taking it far more seriously than they had done at the outset of it, the late 50s into the early 60s. You know, and that wild kind of remit that it had in being associated to trade fairs and, you know, representative teams from cities rather than just clubs as such. But by the time Newcastle are winning it in 69, you know, it's very much the UEFA Cup to be. It's not, UEFA won't have it that it's the, you know, the precursor of the UEFA Cup as such, the official precursor of the UEFA Cup, but it is. It very much is. You know, for me, any team that won the first cup, you know, should be seen as, you know, in the same light as a UEFA Cup winner, you know, and a, you know, Europa League winner, you know, since the rebrand. And, you know, Newcastle's success in 69, fresh off the back of Leeds having won it, you know, a year before Arsenal would win it, and then Leeds would win it again in 71. You know, these were all stepping stones into that, you know, 1970s, early 1980s domination that English clubs had in European competition. And Newcastle's success in 69, you know, it's the last major trophy they've won as such, but what a success it was. You know, every reason, you know, to celebrate that success. You know, Newcastle, you know, fans should not be, you know, bashful about that. You know, this was one of the three major European competitions of its era, and very much, you know, foreshadowing the UEFA Cup. You know, it's way up there for me. You know, and Newcastle fans should very much, you know, embrace that. You know, if they don't, you know, why not? You know, they certainly should do. That success was a huge one, you know, and Frank Clark being part of that as well, you know, and I think, you know, who would go on to win a European Cup in the Nottingham Forest year, you know, a decade later, you know, part of that 74 Cup final side for Newcastle. And yeah, you know, Moncur, so few goals for Newcastle yet. I think it's two that he scores in the first Cup final, you know, over the two legs. And I think it's fantastic as well because it's got that mystique of, I don't think any of us know just who Hugh Besty were and you know, still probably are today, and I think there's something special about those Eastern European clubs and the fact that association to that game, you know, comes against a team that's mysterious and has that little bit of, you know, je ne sais quoi, you know, I think adds to that luster. And yeah, Newcastle's success in the first cup in 69 is, I think, one of Newcastle's greatest achievements.
Well, we certainly do cling on to it, Stephen, not just because it's the last thing that Newcastle won, however many years ago that was now. It's more than 50, that much I know. 55, quick calculation. Deary me, that's a long, long time. Now, we've had mention of various players, Maverick characters and so on. Dave has talked about Malcolm McDonald briefly. I know you love him, really, Dave. But there's also the likes of Hughie Gallagher back in the day, another adopted Geordie, probably in his case, because he then lived in Gateshead long after his playing days and sadly died there too. There was Milburn in the 50s, of course. And then there's the local stars of the 80s, which I think is a really interesting time and an interesting set of players. Obviously, we had Kevin Keegan, the player, between 82 and 84 in the second division. Now, his arrival as a European or former European player of the year, he'd obviously moved from Hamburg to Southampton, but then took a step down to come to Newcastle United. And I think as much as he was reaching the end of his time, he had been part of England's World Cup squad that summer. He still thought he had a chance of being part of the England squad going forward as well. So he wasn't totally ending his career at that point when he arrived, but it was still a bit of a leap of faith, I guess, for him. But in many ways, it was a return home. As much as he's not from Newcastle, his family is largely from that area. And he was a Newcastle fan as a child, which I think is something that his accent hides probably from many people's realization or recollection. But that was very much the case. So that played a huge part and obviously would do so in the following decade when he reappeared again. But he then inspired the club as a player, but then had the likes of Chris Waddle and Peter Beardsley alongside him initially, and inspired both of them to take up his mantle after he'd been helicoptered out of there at the end of the 84 season. And then Paul Gascoigne, of course. So, Steve, I'll come to you again because you're our 80s expert. That's quite a trio to come through at the club in that time. And I just imagine if the club itself in that time had the wherewithal, the ambition, the foresight to actually be able to build on these hugely talented local players that they'd unearthed and developed. Well, in a couple of their cases, Beardsley had been elsewhere and come back. But I guess it's a case of what might have been, really, isn't it?
It is. You know, timing's everything in football, and be able to put a team like that together and have the right man in charge, and you know, there's so much to it. You know, that I don't think we all necessarily comprehend, really. It's why you will get eras of, I think most teams, every team probably can point towards a season or so where it was kind of like, you know, what might have been, or that glorious style of play, you know, and it will be fleeting for some clubs. And yeah, you know, that Newcastle rise of the 1980s from a pretty desperate place as well. I think that's what's impressive about that, is just how desperate a place Newcastle had got themselves into after relegation in 78. You know, 77, they finished, I think, fifth, qualified for the UEFA Cup. The season they went down, 77-78, they played UEFA Cup football, went out to Bastia, who reached the final that year, 77-78. Alan Kennedy, the aforementioned Alan Kennedy, part of that Newcastle side that went down in 77-78 and moved on to Liverpool. But yeah, between kind of relegation 78 and the arrival of Keegan in 82, you know, there were some dark times for Newcastle. You know, financially, in a bad way, the ground, you know, starting to look its age at that point in time. You know, a lot going against Newcastle, you know, and to bring in Keegan in 82 was this massive shot in the arm that just galvanised the club. And they'd not had a bad 81-82. Imre Vardy scoring goals aplenty. And there were reasons to be more cheerful than any of the previous 3 years, probably. So for Keegan to come along and galvanise matters, and then, you know, there's Chris Waddle, and, you know, the arrival of Peter Beardsley, who had wanted so desperately to play for the club. You know, the return of Terry McDermott, who'd lost his way at Liverpool. And suddenly the chemistry, 82, 83, 80, going into 83, 84, is just, it's magnetic. And this is where Newcastle, you know, become kind of like everyone's favourite second team, if you're allowed to have a second team. You know, I think, you know, they were so visible as well at that point in time. You know, I can remember kind of like the Granada region, and we'd have our own version of you know, ITV Sunday afternoon highlights. And so often, you know, we'd get our game from the region, and then it'd be kind of like one or two games plucked from other parts of the region, like would happen across the ITV network. Yet so often, Newcastle would be involved because of Keegan, because of McDermott, those and the style of play. And it was all very swashbuckling, and it was, you know, just letting rip. And again, it was that, I don't know, it leaned into the kind of the Newcastles of the past in that respect. You know, we mentioned that Newcastle side of 54, 55 that win the FA Cup via dysfunction. And again, you know, this is that kind of Newcastle again. And it's just the way that, you know, for that Newcastle, how the stars aligned in that way that they did in 83-84 in a very, very competitive second division that year, you know, packed full of very, very good teams. So you know, it was an adventurous style of play. It caught the imagination and people wanted them to prosper. You know, Sunderland fans aside, obviously, you know, when we've mentioned a little bit of this, and this is where that, I don't know, that admiration that people will have for Newcastle. You know, we said that 55 years since they've won a major trophy, you know, nearly 70 years since they've won a domestic trophy. Yet Newcastle still managed to hold this thrall of people. And you know, I've said before we started recording that, you know, no matter what anyone will think of a specific era of Newcastle, you know, whether you agree with the contemporary version of them and the owners and all that jars in that respect, it still doesn't take away that for the vast majority of us football watchers, there's a Newcastle at some point in your life that you've just absolutely loved and you've wanted to prosper, whether it's that 95-96 version or Bobby Robson's version or that 80s version with Keegan, McDermott, Waddle and Beardsley. You know, you wanted, you were willing them on to achieve whatever that, you know, mountain was that they were trying to climb. And that 80s side tick the box under Arthur Cox, and yes, they win, and so Newcastle of them to go and win promotion, and Keegan, you know, retires, but then off goes Arthur Cox, and in comes Jack Charlton, and it becomes much more pragmatic and less likeable, even for the players involved themselves, let alone independent watchers from a distance who you know, have no, you know, support of the club as such. They just admired what they were doing and loved the style of play and were glad to see them back. And then suddenly it wasn't that Newcastle of the end of the 83-84 season that were coming back into the first division. It was Jack Charlton's first, you know, Newcastle United in 84-85, and it was a very different prospect. But yeah, you know, that 82-84 Newcastle were just such fun to watch, and you wanted them to do well.
Oh, yes. But another false dawn, of course, one amongst many. Now, those players, of course, very iconic, and Gascoigne, who followed a little later. And we all know my thoughts on Mirandina and certain songs there. But we don't need to delve any further. Iconic Mavericks, I guess, are as popular as ever on Tyneside. On it. I don't know whether it's probably not unique to Newcastle at all. But who doesn't love to be entertained, I suppose, by the mercurial and the frustrating stars capable of so much skill and infuriating us as well? I think this magazine features Tino Asprilla, who certainly fits that category, Laurent Robert as well, but you could add in people like David Ginola later on, being equally superb and frustrating, and maybe the likes of Alan Saint-Maximin in more recent times fits that bill. Closer modern equivalent. But then I think there's the goal scorers, and again, maybe cliche Claxon, the whole thing about the Newcastle number nine. I don't know whether that's just a thing for Newcastle fans or whether it is a thing at all. Maybe you guys can help on that front. But you know, you go through the years, we mentioned Hughie Gallagher, Jackie Milburn, there's Malcolm McDonald, of course, Keegan himself, great goal scorers. Andy Cole then comes along. And there's my personal favourite Newcastle striker is Sir Les Ferdinand, of course. And then there's Alan Shearer to top it all off. Now, from my perspective, I guess for all Shearer is untouchable in terms of goal scoring prowess. I always had the affinity. I really love Ferdinand, despite him only being with the club for two seasons. But I guess it's what happened in that time and what he brought, which made him so popular. We lost Andy Cole a few months before, fearing a return to the old selling ways. But then Ferdinand arrives and we stepped up another level. This was a new experience for many Newcastle fans and quite a revelation. His year alongside Shearer as well in his second season had some remarkable moments too. The two of them seemingly complementing each other rather than getting each other's way, which is how it could have turned out, I suppose. But it was a short time. But, you know, to be clear, I do think Shearer is obviously absolutely superb as well. Let's not misunderstand that. But and the fact he opted to come home rather than make a pact with the Red Devil adds to that, certainly. He wanted to fulfil his dream. And while medals would have been nice, I am sure, his dream was of being Newcastle's number nine. And there's something to be admired about that, I think. Although I guess at the time he arrived, Newcastle were very much challenging for medals. But yes, Ferdinand's the one who I seem to have closer to my heart for some reason. But I mean, Dave, am I just stuck in my Geordie bubble of this Newcastle number nine thing, or is it a thing?
No, I think it is. It is a thing. Certainly when I was growing up, it was. I mean, it probably goes back to, you know, the Jackie Milburn kind of era. You know, Malcolm McDonald was seen as sort of following in that around the 74. And then obviously, you know, and I think going back to what Stephen was saying, that's why people have always got a soft spot for Newcastle, because there is that goal scorer that, you know, people love a centre forward. And Newcastle have had a lot of what I suppose you call these old-fashioned centre-forwards. I mean, you know, there's Ferdinand in that sense. He's an old-fashioned centre-forward, you know, rampaging up front and knocking people out of the way and winning fantastic headers and all that. Shearer was similar mould. And I think that is a big thing about Newcastle. Newcastle, I mean, you're both in front of the famous 4-3s and stuff. Newcastle was always a guarantee of goals at both ends. And, you know, if Newcastle were on Match of the Day, or if you got them on Star Soccer as the second game, by and large you knew it was going to be entertaining. You didn't know what was going to happen through, you know, certainly through the 70s, the 80s, and then obviously you'll talk about Keegan's entertainers and stuff later. But that's always what Newcastle have been about, you know. And Jack Charlton, that didn't seem right when Jack Charlton went there, you know, after, you know, we know how Jack Charlton played the game. Newcastle were always the entertaining kind, and you know, going back to the stuff I was saying about Alan Kennedy, sometimes it was entertaining in a comical way, and sometimes it was that swashbuckling, rampaging, you score four, we'll score five kind of way. Yeah, I mean, in some senses, although it didn't work when he was up there, Ozzy Ardiles was the perfect Newcastle manager, because that's exactly what he was all about. He went, again, wrong place, wrong time. But, you know, in another era, Ozzy Ardiles might have been the perfect Newcastle manager, because from afar, that's the kind of way I think a lot of people think about Newcastle and why people have got affection for him. But definitely the number nine thing is a big thing. And, you know, Shearer wouldn't have made such a big song and dance about having it off Les Ferdinand if it hadn't meant something, you know, elsewhere. I think it's, you know, it's one of those trademark things in football. The Newcastle number nine, definitely.
Yeah, that's the irony. Of course, that was the most complex part of the world record transfer fee of Alan Shearer from Blackburn, was the negotiation with Les Ferdinand for the number nine shirt. But yeah, that's the two of them together was just magnificent. Obviously, Shearer has gone on and gone several levels beyond any other Newcastle striker, of course. But you know, when the two of them were together, that was briefly fantastic. Anyway, we're moving on off the field to managers, or managers' eras anyway. The magazine touches on the Keegan years, of course, as well as those of Sir Bobby and a bit around the recent times with Eddie Howe in charge. For me, though, the Keegan years, well, where to go? They were the most incredible time as a Newcastle fan. Now, I know I've talked about this on various podcasts in various ways over the last couple of years, but I have gone to town on it in this magazine, of course. I make no apologies for the length of the piece I've written, although I'm slightly disappointed to discover that Stephen's article has gone slightly longer. But never mind. What I hope it brings through is the incredible transformational qualities that Keegan brought, something Stephen was alluding to of his playing time in the 82-84 era. But he really did transform the club more than once, but in spectacular ways. The extent to which he transformed, I think, was obviously even greater as a manager in the 1990s than it had been as a player. For the club to go from the brink of the third tier, the potential financial implosion of the club that seemed set to bring, to then coming oh so close to winning the Premier League, all within the span of just 4 years. And that's what I find absolutely remarkable about the transformation. It was a very short space of time to go from a club that was on its deathbed almost, sinking without a trace, within 2 years being in the Premier League, ripping it up in entertaining style, and within 4 years coming so close to winning the whole thing. If you then add in the manner in which it was done, the style of play, the excitement, the entertainment, we as Newcastle fans were carried along on a roller coaster ride, I guess, of endless thrills and magical moments, and a few disappointing ones too. But, you know, you get the ups and the downs. And as you mentioned, even those not fortunate enough to come from this part of the world swept along with us as well to some extent. I guess it's another cliche, but it's been alluded to as well, of Newcastle being many other second favourite. And I guess part of this era is when that came about as well. Probably most the case in the 93-94 time, and their first season up, when they were purely entertaining, scoring for fun, exciting, scoring at will, like I say, Cole Beardsley in particular. It was astonishing strike weight. But I guess probably crucially, they weren't a real danger to those at the very top, and that helps people like you, I think. Maybe 2 years later, that was a little bit different when they were actually challenging. But I would still assume that most neutrals beyond the confines of Manchester United and Sunderland, of course, were hoping for a Newcastle triumph in the league once their own teams were out of contention anyway. And it wasn't to be, and that's a real shame. And this is something I really try to hammer home in the article. To me, the failure to win the league does nothing in my mind at all to diminish Keegan's achievements in this short space of time. It would have been the glitter on the top, but it doesn't lessen the achievement. I think 4 years to go from such a low to such a high is incredible. The whole club was transformed in that time. The city itself was utterly transformed too. And I think that's something that those not from the area might not realize or see, just how much the city became a buzz with excitement. It was as if that excitement brought by the football club had seeped into every aspect of life in Newcastle. It was becoming increasingly more a party town destination as well. During this era, this is also the time of the sporting club project of Sir John Hall, where the rugby club, basketball and ice hockey, but I guess the football and rugby were the two principal ones, were a big thing. The rugby club Falcons were achieving great success with Rob Andrew as their Kevin Keegan figure. And you could be out in town during this era, and in one bar, you're mixing it with the footballers, and then you move next door and there's a whole load of rugby players just out and about in the town. Maybe they did a bit too much drinking, and maybe that's why things were wrong. I don't know. But anyway, it was an exciting, exciting time. And we had a whole host of heroes from this whole era. If you can go from David Kelly, who is still very much a hero to Newcastle minds, and his goals, which saved the club in the early Keegan months, to the arrival of Beardsley, then Beresford, my favourite player of this whole time, Robert Lee. Then Andy Cole, his incredible partnership with Beardsley. There's Gillespie, Fernand, you know, Philippe Albert, Aspria, several local stars in the mix as well. It was a remarkable time. And let's not forget it was in the greatest kit of modern times too, but that's another thing. But just to think of that list of players who only a couple of years earlier in the Ardiles era that Dave was mentioning there, or Jim Smith before that, to think of some of these players pitching up at St. James's, if you'd said the ride that we were about to go on at that time, you'd have been laughed out of town. It would just been so ludicrous as to be beyond belief. And sure, it would have been great if we'd won the league in 1996. And yes, of course, it hurt when it all went wrong. The home loss to Manchester United, I guess, was the real killer in terms of the shift in momentum and missed opportunity and missed points, I suppose, a six-pointer ultimately in the grand scheme of things. Even if the subsequent drama at Anfield and Ewood Park just added to the pain in different ways. But having come so far in such a short space of time, Keegan, to me, can only be considered as a huge success as a manager for Newcastle United. I think people looking in from the outside might not view it that way because they just see the end point. And to me, that's not fair as a way to assess the overall. I think he is, to Newcastle fans, he's rightly lauded as our greatest manager of modern times. And beyond that, simply the most influential transformational character on the club and the club's influence across the city in recent decades. I think that's beyond question. Finishing second in the league doesn't change that one bit. So anyway, that's my black and white perspective on it all. And I expand on that in written form. But for you both, I guess, what are your memories of Newcastle at that time? And from your outside perspectives, how do you view the Keegan managerial era? Stephen, I'll come to you. You're not allowed to mention 4-3 or anything like that.
Okay, I'll not mention that one. Dave got the mentioning earlier on. And as tempting as it is, I'll try not to, put it that way. But yeah, you know, again, you know, they were just so, like you say, so entertaining to watch. They were must watch, you know, football at that point in time. You know, they were just so kind of flowing and without fear. I think that's what kind of like catches football fans' imaginations, is seeing a team play with that innate confidence that, you know, anything is possible here. And that's what Keegan did for Newcastle, you know, to take them from the, like you say, the depths of, you know, from the jaws of the third division, you know, which would have been catastrophic for Newcastle. This at a point in time where Middlesbrough, you know, not all that far away geographically, had gone to the very brink, you know, in the mid-1980s with a visit to the third division. Sunderland had dipped in and clawed the way out. And you were looking at that Newcastle and thinking, good God, if you end up in there, will you ever come back? I think that was what a lot of people were thinking, really. And Keegan had notoriously said that he had no intention of being a football manager. He walked away from football in 84 in terms of a hands-on nature. And until, what was it, the February of 92, had no intention of being drawn back into the game. You know, he was happy. You know, he was playing golf. He was, you know, spending half of his year in Marbella. You know, he had his business interests. He had no need to come back to football. He'd, you know, tip up in ITV studios covering games for them. You know, he was happy with life. And Newcastle were the only proposition that would have dragged him back in. You know, I think even Liverpool would come asking. I don't think he'd have done it. You know, and he loves Liverpool as a football club. You know, but Newcastle is his passion. He took it on, brought McDermott along with him, and it was just this. Like you say, you the word transformational. He took a leaf or two out of the Shankly, you know, textbook in that respect, in that you know the way that, you know, one individual can galvanise the people that surround him, and this. Concept germinates and suddenly that infectious nature spreads. You know, once it spreads onto the terraces, you know, and onto the pitch, and what the players are doing, what the supporters are doing, then it becomes an irresistible thing to watch and to be a voyeur of. You know, even as an outsider, you know, you're kind of swept away by that. That's what that Newcastle did. You know, they walked into the Premier League. You know, what a year on from having just missed out, you know, just avoided the third division, and never looked out of place. They hit the floor running, you know, and they were so, so good. And to have Andy Cole scoring those goals, Beardsley back, you know, they were just playing some fantastic football. And you can look at like the Tottenham of the early 1980s of being that entertaining side, of our dealers being part of, you know, tying into what Dave was saying about our dealers. You know, Ricky Veer and Glenn Hoddle, and we all loved watching them as you know, beyond our own teams. And I think that entertaining team will always draw you in that respect. And that was Keegan's Newcastle at that point in time, that early to mid 1990s. They were just fantastic to watch, and it was kind of like you, even as an outsider, you got joy in that, because I think as a football fan, you know, some football fans, can get enjoyment out of a team doing well and seeing the supporters loving it, because they can relate to that. Whether that's kind of like a concept of saying we've lived that type of experience, or we're attaining, you know, we're reaching for our own version of that. They were just such an infectious side in the best possible terms. And yeah, you know, that losing out on that title in 95, 96, you know, it's Brazil 82. It's all of those type of, you know, in English club form, that's what it is. I don't think there's any other comparable one that you could that I can think of off the top of my head where people would think, really wish that team would have won that. But at the same time, it doesn't matter that they didn't. Because it doesn't matter that Brazil didn't win the 82 World Cup when it came to it, because of the joy that they gave. And Newcastle the same. I think the only thing that would have been, you know, could have improved that 95-96 team is that if Newcastle had to fumble it, it was Liverpool that would have taken it instead of Manchester United. Because that was just an unpalatable punchline at the end. But, you know, for not just Newcastle fans, but the nation, I'd like to think.
Well, yes. I mean, any joke at Manchester United's expense is generally fine with me, but that might have been going a step too far that time around, Stephen. Dave, same question to you, I guess, thoughts of that time. Is it really, I guess, in modern times, is the most remarkable Newcastle era?
You probably won't agree, but I think the fact that they didn't win the title is actually better.
I might struggle with that one.
No, there's something particularly beguiling about the beautiful loser thing that makes it last longer. I mean, Albion had that in 78, 79, the Cyril Regis team, when it was Liverpool, so you can have that one, Stephen, who stopped Albion winning the league. I mean, yeah, I think finishing second, it doesn't mean failure. You know, I mean, Newcastle were unfortunate, just as Albion were unfortunate in 78-9, when I think it was the best Liverpool team to win the league that season. I think of all the leagues that they won, that was the best team. In Newcastle's case, they just came across this juggernaut of Manchester United that weren't going to give up the title to anybody. And there's no shame in that, because that was a magnificent side. In the same way that over the last 5 or 6 years, Liverpool have won one title. Well, Manchester City were magnificent over that period. It doesn't reduce anything that Jurgen Klopp did at Liverpool over that period, or anything that Liverpool did. They were still a fantastic side. It was just that somebody was just slightly better that time. But
yeah, that ties into what I was saying early on about timing being everything. You know, you look at that Manchester United in 95, 96, and they'd had that loss of the title the year earlier in 94-95. Great believer in domino effects in football. I think if it's Blackburn that blow the title in 94-95, I think Newcastle probably win it in 95-96. In the same way that Graham Taylor's Aston Villa in 89-90 probably win the first division if Liverpool don't lose that one in the last few seconds against Arsenal in 88-89. Because it's that fatigue nature as well. You know, so it is, it really is timing being everything. Maybe, you know, if that Newcastle in 95-96 had made that particular run a year earlier, you know, that's their league title. If you transplant that 95-96 Newcastle side into the 94-95 season, they win that league, you know, without a shadow of a doubt. There are other years when they win that league. It's just that Newcastle came up against a team like West Brom in 78-79 that had been there, done it, and they'd kind of like missed out the previous season and were back to rectify that. And it was just that know-how in the end. But, you know, it doesn't detract at all.
Absolutely. You know, I think the point is that people remember that team probably more than the Manchester United team that won the league that season, far more so. I mean, in the end, isn't that more important? You know, we are talking 30 years down the road. I mean, great, if you'd won the title on the day and you'd lifted the trophy, and believe me, we've won less than you have. So, I know. But, you know, it's one day and you get the pot, and that's great. And maybe you go on to do more as a result, but maybe you don't. But, you know, the fact that we're all still talking about those games and those goals and those performances and everything, I think, you know, the fact that you came second just adds to it. It's got that beguiling thing to it. And I will also say about Kevin Keegan, I think he's the most underrated personality in English football. The thing, you know, he still very rarely gets talked about unless you're digging up something like this. But as a player and then as a manager, I don't think anybody by sheer force of personality has achieved more than Kevin Keegan in his time. And okay, he didn't win things with Newcastle, but again, he changed the landscape. He changed the way people thought about football. In that early period of the Premier League, when we were getting used to watching television, football on television all the time, he made it entertaining more than anybody, you know. And I think, you know, the legacy of Kevin Keegan is monumental in English football, and obviously particularly at Newcastle and Liverpool, sorry.
It is. Just going with Keegan there, he was never the most natural. No, naturally, he wasn't the most naturally gifted footballer. He worked at everything that he did. He was tireless in his effort behind everything. You know, if he wasn't perfect at something, he would work and work and work on the training ground. And you can say very similar to his managerial career. Tactically, you know, maybe that little bit short of being able to keep up with the Wengers and the Fergusons and all of that era. Yet, you know, he was that inspiration in a way that nobody else could match. He was properly inspiring to his players, to the supporters of his football club, you know, even to those watching on the outside looking in.
Yeah, you mentioned a word earlier, that infectious, and I think that's what Keegan is. His personality is infectious, and you can't help but be drawn along and pulled along by him.
Yeah, I mean, I what did I say? I spoke not so long about it. Keegan, kind of like his relationship with Liverpool, you know, has kind of like been a bit of a detached one almost since he left as a player. Never been involved with the club ever since, really. Yet that love and respect for those supporters that watched him in that era, you know, is still massive. And it was great. A couple of seasons ago, he came. He was the match day kind of like guest and doing kind of like the halftime stuff and all that type of thing, which is quite rare. You know, I've not seen him too many times coming back and doing that. Yet he absolutely loved it. And that was the thing. He was outside the stadium making his way into the ground, and supporters of a certain age were going up to him and getting the selfies and all that type of stuff. And a lot of football players, you know, in the past don't like that type of thing. Yet there was Keegan stopping for absolutely everyone with the broadest smile and, you know, just, you know, arm around the shoulders, not just posing for photos, but arm around the shoulders and all that type of stuff. And he couldn't do enough. And, you know, I watched from afar because I'm not one of those people to approach my heroes. I let them just be, but there he was, absolutely loving his day. And that, for me, spoke, you know, wonders about him as well.
No, absolutely. And going back to what Dave was saying about who gets remembered most, I'll take Johan Cruyff's word on this one that maybe we won after all, since people remember us more. And we'll cling on to that. Obviously, Sir Bobby Robson came along a few years later, having been close actually to joining post-Keegan. Brought an awful lot of stability and statesmanship, I think, to the club after a couple of years of post-Keegan decline and other rise in fortunes. And as with Keegan, he brought a real feel-good factor again, a degree of style too, if not quite as swashbuckling. But another exciting time, if ultimately another one doomed to no tangible glory. But his era gets focus in the magazine as well. Now, I did also write another piece in this one, as I mentioned earlier, which is on the local derbies against you-know-who from down the road, giving the whole rivalry a bit of historical context, stemming as it does from fighting on opposing sides in the Civil War and associated disputes around coal mining rights, and into more modern gripes, of course. But it's more than what I guess it may seem from the outside, as just some parochial local squabble of minimal importance between two clubs that never win anything. My piece delves into a few of my Derby memories anyway, through some key matches over the last few decades. Oddly, the 1990 playoff semi-final only gets passing mention. Well, the goals of Shola Amiobi get a bit more focus, which is only right, I think. Runs of defeats don't get too much of a mention either. To bring us up to the modern day, though, the most recent iteration of the Derby was in the third round of the FA Cup last season. It was a bit of an odd one, really. It was the first game between the two in 7 or 8 years since Sunderland had been wallowing in the depths of the lower leagues for a little while. And being a cup game too, there was a far bigger away contingent of Geordies venturing south, or being allowed to venture south, which made it a very unusual and incredible occasion, I think. And for Newcastle, I guess, given the gulf between the sides at that point, Sunderland are doing very well in the Championship this season, but they're a bit slightly further back at that point, and had only just come up from the third tier. It had banana skin written all over it from a Newcastle perspective, but thankfully quality told, and I got to breathe a huge sigh of relief more than anything else. But that's what Derby games often are. I think victory is a relief, defeat is a disaster, and we've experienced plenty of both. My article on it naturally focuses, of course, on some more positive occasions for Newcastle. It's very blinkered, but I was never going to write anything remotely even-handed when discussing our rivalry with that lot. So that is there to be enjoyed as well. Any historical wars coming into your local rivalries in the West Midlands, Dave?
I insist that it's the Black Country Derby, and of course everybody knows that Wolverhampton isn't in the Black Country. That's
crazy. Well, they're just trying to cling onto your coattails there, I think, Dave. You know, just trying to get... Anyway, into modern times, Newcastle United is very much changed. In recent years, of course, the moribund pointlessness of merely existing as a free advertising board for Mike Ashley and his particular brand of sporting goods, the farce of Joe Kinnear...
I've resisted using that cup. So that big, huge novelty mug tonight, Aidan.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. It's a solidarity there, Stephen. Thank you. The farce of Joe Kinnear, Keegan's ill-fated return and constructive dismissal from Mike Ashley, the years of Pardew and headbutting people on the touchline. Steve McLaren, Steve Bruce. Pardew did have a brief period of joy. Houghton also brought a bit of class to proceedings briefly, but behind the scenes, things were pared to the bone. It was pretty horrific, really. Ashley gambled on spending the minimum to avoid relegation and nothing more, and he lost that bet twice, but didn't change anything in his approach. All he was interested in was the free advertising, of course, and those mugs. This explains part of the joy, I guess, once the takeover went through, you know, mixed with the slightly naive view, as it turns out, certainly, that Newcastle had won the lottery and were destined for big spending glory. And then there are, of course, the Saudi considerations as well, and all that comes with that, which is something talked about in a few previous pods as well. In footballing terms, though, while Newcastle have progressed in the PIF Eddie Howe era, financial rules, as Dave mentioned earlier, mean there's a bit of a limit to how far it can go at the moment. There's talk of stadium renovation or new build, and there's plans for growing revenue and all those lovely things that we love to talk about, the reality of modern football. On the field, though, at least there are exciting players again, and that's a delight to behold. There's a club that actually wants to try and achieve. Whether they do or not is a whole different matter, but they actually are actively trying to, and that is great. Whereas under Ashley, the stated intent was to not try and compete, merely to exist. So, Stephen, before we get towards a close here, what do you make of the current Newcastle and prospects for the future?
I think moving away from Mike Ashley it has to be seen as a positive. I think we all wish it was in a different, a different way. It could be different, but modern football, it is what it is. Outsourcing ownership of football clubs. We're talking, stones and glass house, era of things. Slander is very much thrown around about ownerships of football clubs, yet increasingly the most famous footballing institutions are falling into foreign ownership, and there is that element of it as well. It is, and yes, there is that uncomfortable nature to so much of it, but at the same time, you just can't begrudge a club like Newcastle feeling like they've won the lottery and to be able to to do things basically and to find utopia, you know, shall we say. But we'll all, you know, certainly those of us of a Generation X nature, you know, we've drawn our line in the sand with football, you know, of what football was and what football is. I don't know, the contemporary game, it turned so many of us off. But I think Newcastle doing well feels right. I think it's fair to say that we just wish it would have been, you know, doing this, I don't know, under the halls, you know, and that rumbling on forever rather than, you know, the way ownership has diversified at Newcastle over the years. And it's not, and that's to say, it's not just a Newcastle thing at all. And within that, you know, how would any of us react if that came to our clubs? You know, and unless you've been in that position, I don't think you can, you know, properly, you know, say how it would be.
No, I think that's fair, and it's ongoing saga, of course, and we'll see where it goes. But yes, the modern football is a different beast, shall we say? You know, Dave, same to you. You know, what are your thoughts of current Newcastle United and where things may be headed?
As far as the supporters are concerned, good luck to them, because I mean, it's been a long, long wait for a trophy, and I hope it ends fairly soon. I hope it ends at Wembley in May. That'd be great. You know, a problem with Newcastle lifting the FA Cup and putting a shirt on the Angel of the North and all that again. I mean, my concern in football in terms is, please, God, don't move from St James's Park. I mean, I can understand why Everton have got to move from Goodison, because there's nothing you can do with Goodison Park anymore in the modern era. But I mean, that St James's Park at the top of the city, overlooking everything and the environs around it. I mean, that is. Yeah, for all that it's been expanded so much over the years, and it's not the ground that it was in the 70s and blah, 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 it's one of the great football grounds, end of the story. And you can't take that away. You can't move that. That it has to stay there. Now, whether, I don't know what scope there is for redeveloping it into what the ownership would want it to be, I don't know. There seems to be a reasonable amount in the room there compared with others. Or whether you do something like what Tottenham did and build a new ground on essentially the same site. And here's an idea for you, Aidan. Share the stadium alive for a couple of years.
Oh, God.
you cannot move from St James's Park.
You joke there, Dave, but this is one of the real points of discussion.
Yes, I know,
around
right,
this. is what would happen if it was a rebuild? Where would we play? Because there isn't, it's not like when Tottenham were doing it, they could just shift across town to Wembley. There aren't alternatives in the area beyond the unpalatable. Frankly, I'd rather we played up in Edinburgh than there, but hey, who knows? And in terms of the site, I mean, you're right in terms of the history, that it's a real emotive topic right now, because plans are afoot, things are being looked at, and something, whatever that will be, is going to be announced in the new year at some point. The site itself, as much as there's green space behind it, it is actually restricted by listed buildings, which is why it's so lopsided currently, and a road on the other side. So expanding is awkward. It is difficult. However, you could see the possibility of a new stadium that's almost on exactly the same site, which is probably as good as that can get. But yeah, the thought of moving further from the city centre is very unpalatable to a lot of people. The fact that you can walk to it from anywhere in the central areas of the city, and people do, if you had to travel elsewhere in the city, as is the case with various clubs, that would feel like we'd lost quite a lot. And equally, as you talked about there, the fact you can see the stadium on top of the hill from all around, it dominates the skyline, dominates the city, and that's a nice thing. But yes, we shall see on that. It is a very emotive topic, but it's, as in modern times, it's more about the finances and the bottom line than soul and history. But we shall see where that goes. Anyway, we'll bring things towards a conclusion with a few quickfire questions for you both. Time-honoured tradition. So, Stephen, best Newcastle player in your memory?
Oh, I've got to say, for pure enjoyment, maybe answering my own question there rather than the one you're asking, best player, you've got to go with an Alan Shearer, haven't you? But I think most enjoyable player, Tino Asprey. Okay. It was just so much, again, going back to it, so much fun to watch. You know, and yeah. So enjoy, most enjoyable Tino Asprey, the best, got to be Alan Shearer, really.
Okay. Dave?
Well, if I can have the two answers in the same way. You can't get away from Alan Shearer, can you? I mean, you know, 200 and God knows how many goals and all of that. I would say that David Ginola played his best football at Newcastle, and I'm always a sucker for wingers, so yeah, I always love watching him.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, I mean, I have to agree on the best Newcastle player in my memory. It has to be Alan Shearer. You can't really discuss beyond that. And yes, from the enjoyment perspective, oh, too difficult. I'll go back to the Les Ferdinand thing I mentioned earlier. Anyway, Dave, next one to you first. Favourite current Newcastle player?
I was just writing about Alexander Isaac for the Ipswich programme, and a fellow who scores as many goals as he does, you know, for Newcastle, the Newcastle centre forward, I think you can't get away from him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely superb player. I love that his close control. There was an example of this against Leicester the other day. It didn't come to anything, but the way he sort of danced in between three or four defenders just with the ball seemingly tied to his laces was magnificent. And he's got a real eye for goal, of course, in traditional style. So, yes, I wouldn't disagree too much with that. But, Stephen, what do you think?
I think I'd have to agree with Dave's choice there. You know, it's that, I don't know, that freedom of expression that I'm an absolute sucker for. And, you know, and again, you know, contemporary football, fewer and far between to get a player who has that freedom. You know, it's a bit like the Liverpool concept of having absolutely loved watching Bobby Firmino play and just how popular he was in a Liverpool shirt, despite all of the other players that were surrounding him, you know, to be so popular. Players like that are popular for a reason, because they just, I don't know, they embody the way that the supporters want the football to be. You know, they play the way that they would want to play themselves.
Oh, brilliant. Shout out to Bruno Guimarães and also cult hero status for Joel Linton. I think his transformation in recent times is nothing short of remarkable, and he is a huge fan favourite, if a complete pain in the backside to everyone who supports the opposition. Okay, Stephen, favourite Newcastle era?
Ooh, toss of a coin. I'd have to go, being Generation X and an 80s kid, I'm going to have to go for Keegan's playing era. That 82, 83, 84 span. You know, Beardsley, Waddle, you know, McDermott, you know, all of that. I think rising from such a low point as well. For me, yeah, 82 to 84.
We do an awful lot of rising from extremely low points, it seems, don't we? But there we go. That's our history. Dave, how about you? Favourite era?
We've discussed all this on the decades thing. I think that, you know, when you're sort of 10, 11, 12, it's hardwired into you that's what you think of all the time. And it is that sort of 70s team I was writing about in the thing. You know, it's Jimmy Smith and Stuart Barraclough and, you know, even McDonald. And the kit and St James's Park on Match of the Day and all that, it all sort of came together in one thing, you know, I think. So that sort of 73, 74, 75, 76 period, I'd say.
Oh, excellent. Okay, well, it probably comes as no great surprise that the mid-90s is mine. Now, as you know, I'm same age as Stephen, so obviously formative years in the 80s, and that was a brilliant introduction. But the roller coaster ride at that time was just unsurpassed in my supporting experience. So I will have to go for that one. Okay, final one. Dave, you can go first here. Fondest memory of a Newcastle side? Moment, player, incident? In a positive way, though, please.
It is 74. I mean, everything about that game at the Albion, although the Albion lost 3-0, we're never in the game. It's just burnt into me. I mean, on a personal level, we went in the Smethwick end, and it was rammed. You could not see a thing. And I was, 9 at the time. And I was too big to get on my dad's shoulders, which I'd done about 3 or 4 years earlier when Manchester United had played at the Albion. And it, we couldn't say anything. It was so bad. We were thinking about going home after about 10 minutes because you just couldn't say anything. And we were walking around the back of the Smithic to where the rainbow stand, and the rainbow stand had about 10 years old. So the rainbow stand was like being in heaven. This was the biggest thing on earth. And my dad saw a steward, and he knew him from work, and he said, yeah, there's a couple of seats at the back coming in. So we sat at the back of the rainbow stand. This was good enough. I didn't care about the football. I was sitting in the rainbow stand. And to be fair, Newcastle were unbelievable at that. It was a quagmire of a pitch. You've seen it on YouTube, I'm sure. And they were fantastic. Malcolm McDonald, you know, I mean, he was like, same as Francis Lee, got size like trees, and he was just mowing his way through the mud and getting on the end of everything. John Tudor was winning everything in the air. Albion couldn't handle it. And it was as good a team as I'd seen for, you know, at that age in the flesh. So that fifth round FA Cup 1974, March.
Magnificent. What could possibly go wrong in that cup run from there? Anyway, Stephen, your fondest memory of Newcastle United?
Having given all the kind of like, you know, child of the 80s, Generation X type of stuff, I'm going to go the opposite way and say that 96, 97 demolition of Manchester United, not long before Keegan resigns, actually. You know, and the Philippe Albert, you know, chip over Schmeichel and all of that. It was just, you know, it was a glorious kind of way to vent frustration, really, over what had happened at the end of 95, 96. And it was peak Keegan in so many respects in terms of what he was about and what his teams were capable of. And it was a Sunday afternoon where you just had to properly take your hat off to them and say that was unreal. To dismantle that Manchester United side in that manner. You know, and another Manchester United side that would actually go on and win the league again that season. But just for that afternoon there, it just felt like, wow, that is a real, you know, statement of intent. And granted, it didn't go, you know, where we thought it could have done. Events were to escalate very, very swiftly. You know, that riposte was just magical to watch.
Well, oddly enough, I've jotted down here for my answer to this, Philippe Albert's chip goal in the 5-0. you know, perfect answer then, what can I say?
Well, anyway, you have that one, and I'll go for Keegan and the helicopter at the end of the testimony.
Well, yes, that was memorable too, and I was in the first school at the time, and I didn't have tickets for that occasion. They were hard to come by, but the one guy in my class who did have tickets was tasked with buying a match program for everybody else, and the next day he came in with an absolute hat full of them, with Auf Wiedersehen Kev on the cover. Which was superb. Dave, that would have been a program you'd have been proud to have been part of. But yeah, since we've mentioned Philippe Albert a couple of times, I will pick another one as well, which I guess is a more personal one, but from the early days of Keegan's managerial return, going up on a packed Gallagher Terrace, as it still was at the time, very crumbly. But the sheer joy, and I talk about this in the Keegan Entertainment piece, the early part of that era, where you had to be in the ground a long time before kickoff to secure your place and your position. And there was all sorts of entertainment and sing-alongs going on. And it was a great, fun time where suddenly all sorts of positivity was there and everything seemed possible. And little did we know the journey we were about to go on and how it ended, but it was a fun, fun time. Anyway, we shall end it there. The magazine, yes, I should mention that again. The magazine is out on the 2nd of January. So, yes, get your orders in. It will be a beautiful ode to all things black and white, and I'm sure there may be a little bit of splash of colour in there somewhere, but they could have saved on printing costs and just done it all black and white. We'll see how it turns out. But thank you very much, both of you, for your contributions. Thank you, Dave.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And we played nicely.
You have indeed. Well done. No mention of a certain player and a crazy goal in the 70s. We don't need to go there. And thank you very much, Stephen. I have not ended this pod slumped over an advertising hoarding in despair.
I'm glad that is the case. It's been, you know, count this as a win.
That's all we can do is cling to little victories. Well, thank you very much, and do join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with East Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.